This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome once again to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 35th episode. Today, we tackle an article from the pediatric endocrine literature, but one that might impact the care that both pediatric and adult endocrinologists provide. This study in the JCENM looks at the reproductive impact of cryptorchidism, a common issue for us to wrestle with in male reproductive endocrinology. As is typical for us in this podcast, the authors of this paper use an observational study design, so we will look closely at that. Before I introduce the rest of our group today, I will remind you that I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop, working as a general adult endocrinologist at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center, where I also direct our outpatient endocrinology clinics and serve as an associate director for our fellowship program. Joining me today are two pediatric endocrinologists. Marcella Vargas returns as our regular contributor. She practices at the Rady Children's Hospital in San Diego and is an associate professor at UC San Diego. Her clinical interests focus on differences of sex development and puberty, and she directs the multidisciplinary DST clinic at Rady Children's. Our guest expert today is Alan Rogel. He is an emeritus professor at the University of Virginia and is one of the world's experts in puberty and growth disorders in children. He is well known to you all from his publications and talks in these areas, in addition to many leadership roles in the Endocrine Society and Lawson Wilkins Pediatric Endocrine Society. As you can tell, I am yet again joined by the perfect pair of endocrinologists for this discussion. Also, everything that we will say will be our opinions only and not those either of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. For this month's episode of the podcast, we review reproductive markers of testicular function and size during puberty in boys with and without a history of cryptorchidism, which the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism published in December 2022. Vivat Rod-Prassert and Jaakko Koskiniemi from the University of Turku in Finland served as first authors for this report. Now I'll turn things over to Marcella. She will walk us through the points that the authors make in their introduction. Additionally, she and Alan will help us understand some key concepts in this area as we go through that introduction. Marcella?
Thank you for the introduction. I'm quite excited to review this paper with both of you. So first, I'll start with the definition of cryptorchidism. Cryptorchidism can happen when one or both testes fail to descend to the scrotum. And it is important to mention that this is the most common congenital anomaly among newborn boys. So as we all know, sometimes the testes do descend spontaneously. And when this happens, it usually occurs between the ages of 3 to 6 months. However, in some boys, the descent does not occur spontaneously, and this is when orchiopexy is recommended. There are different guidelines for the recommendation of what is the best age to perform orchiopexy at, but most current guidelines agree that somewhere around 6 to 12 months of age or up to 18 months at the latest is what's the current recommendation. Orchiopexy is necessary because there are risks from undescended testes. And two well-known risks include risk for testicular germ cell tumors and for infertility. Alan, I'm going to ask you to please briefly review the mechanisms for these two effects.
Thank you, Marcella. There is a real problem with trying to figure out what is the primary or root cause, because it's likely to be in fetal development and the testis doesn't descend mainly because it might not be a normal testis. And it's very difficult, obviously, to do any experiments for the fetus. It does descend depending upon not being blocked physically and having enough of a hormone that we're just learning about, INSL3, insulin-like hormone 3. And that is important for the descensus of the testis. Importantly, it is, as you had mentioned, the incidence of cryptorchidism, unilateral or bilateral, is greater at birth than it is at 3 or 6 months. You don't want to operate on neonates and really young kids, but there's another reason not to operate, and that's because there is probably 50% or so descensus of a testis that was cryptorchid at birth. Looking forward, will this testis have a germ cell tumor? Well, that probably depends upon how abnormal it was during fetal life, rather than just being in the position where it is, whether it's intra-abdominal, where the temperature is higher, or it is somewhere below the abdomen and the scrotum. The other issue is infertility, and that's even more difficult. As I've reviewed some papers actually over 30 or 40 years, yes, the relative risk of infertility in a cryptorchid testis is higher, 2, 3, maybe 4-fold, but it's years later down the road, and there could be many other things that have happened to the individual before he shows up in an infertility clinic.
Thank you for that answer. And as you just said it, it is well known and there's plenty of data showing that there is higher risk for germ cell tumors and infertility. However, we do know that there are other risk factors from cryptorchidism, but the mechanisms for these are still unclear or if they even actually occur. And the two main potential risks that can occur from cryptorchidism that are still unclear include testicular development and hormone production during puberty. So in this study, the authors wanted to look at these potential risks. However, before we go into the details of the study aims, I wanted to ask you, Alan, if you could please share with us, how do you typically counsel families regarding these risks? We know there is data out there. There are studies that have looked at this. However, the data is scant and the results are conflicting. So based on this uncertainty, how do you typically counsel your patients and families?
This is precisely why you are a doctor and not a technician. The first thought in talking to parents, usually it's not me because they don't come to see the endocrinologist right away, but we would tell our neonatologist to say there is a great chance of having spontaneous descent. At about 3 to 6 months, if I see the child, I would say to them, let's wait till at least 6 months. If it doesn't come down, then we should operate somewhere within the first year of life. Now, when I was in the middle of my practice, that's when nafarellin and some of the other GnRH agonists came out, and one had a number of studies that showed whether if you gave a GnRH or if you gave HCG to try to have the testis come down, first of all, it wasn't very effective. And second of all, if it was effective, then often the testes would go back up. And so it seems to me, based especially on those studies from the middle 80s, that surgical correction, very rarely done in two stages, is the appropriate way. I believe there are some studies that show that at 9 months is better than 2 or 3 years to do surgery. And certainly the before puberty is really a long time to wait. So it's talking to the parents and saying that there may be descensus, and if there isn't, this is the program to go on.
So now I'm going to review the study aims, which were to understand the effect of cryptorchidism on pubertal hormone production and testicular development in children with a history of cryptorchidism. So they did this by evaluating some outcomes during puberty. The outcomes included hormone levels, which included LH, FSH, testosterone, inhibin B, SHBG, and insulin-like factor 3. They also measured growth factors, including IGF-1 and IGF-BP3, and they measured testicular volumes. They looked at all of these in three different groups, which included boys with cryptorchidism who had spontaneous descent, boys with cryptorchidism who required orchiopexy, and boys without a history of cryptorchidism, which served as controls. It is important to mention that they did not state a hypothesis. So the authors did say that they had already conducted a prior study in which they looked at testicular growth in puberty in boys with a history of cryptorchidism. And in that study, they did see that boys with cryptorchidism had a smaller testicular size, indicating smaller Sertoli cell and germ cell populations in these boys. However, they did not hypothesize anything regarding the puberty hormone production in boys with a history of cryptorchidism.
Great. Thanks, Marcella and Alan as well. So I think you guys have really highlighted the dearth of literature that's here. We don't have a good understanding exactly what's going on here and what we need to be doing about it. But obviously, the decisions that are made in early life for these boys have impacts all the way up through adulthood that affects both pediatric and adult endocrinologists. So important information that we need to be sifting through here. So what we're going to do is we normally do or think about the study design in general here. And as I looked at this, I think this best fits as a prospective cohort study. So just to describe what that is in general, we've looked at a few of these studies over the past few years, but what makes a study a cohort study is when you have a larger group, that's your cohort in general, and then within that group, you have those who are exposed and unexposed to something, and we'll apply it to the study here in just a second. Sometimes you can have degrees of exposure, so you can sometimes have multiple groups, but a minimum, you've got two, a group that's exposed, a group that's unexposed. And then what makes it a cohort study is that you then follow those individuals over time for the development of an outcome or outcomes to see if one group versus the other develops it more frequently. So that makes it a cohort study. What makes it a prospective cohort study is that these authors, these investigators, follow these individuals, these subjects in real time. Retrospective cohort studies are started after the data is all complete. You have all the data already. Maybe it's a chart review, maybe it's a database, but it already exists. You're just going back and sorting through that. Prospective, you design it up front, and the real strength of that is you're able to say, this is all of the information that we're going to need, and so we're going to collect it along the way. You're not just stuck with what you have at the end, as is the case for retrospective studies, but you're able to define up front what you're going to collect. It's very time consuming to do these, particularly these ones that take years for the outcomes to develop, as is the case here, but can be very strong because you have full control over what information you're collecting. So that's what a prospective cohort study is. So now we're going to apply it to this study in particular. So the subjects here, and this includes those with cryptorchidism and those without, were mostly invited from previous studies of boys born at Turku University Hospital in Finland. That was between 1997 and 2002. The authors have been very active in this space and had previously done several studies, and so reached out to those individuals, studies that were done around the time of birth, and invited those individuals to continue on with an investigation around the time of puberty. So of those groups that were invited, they got 63 individuals to serve as controls, so those who did not have cryptorchidism, and then 46 who did have cryptorchidism. So they've subdivided this. I'm going to comment here, and we're going to come back to this repeatedly throughout this discussion, but of those 46 individuals with cryptorchidism, 30 of them had unilateral disease, and half of those required surgical correction, and half of those had a spontaneous descent and did not require surgical correction. And then there were 16 of those 46 individuals with cryptorchidism who had bilateral disease, and just over half, 9, had surgical correction, but 7 had spontaneous descent. So again, we're going to come back to those, and as Marcella walks us through the results, we'll think about those different groups, that depending on how you define it, up to 5 different groups here. A few comments on the exclusion criteria as applied by the author. So you could not have monorchidism. For the control group, there could not be any acquired cryptorchidism. So you had to have both be abnormal testicular location at birth and then did not develop cryptorchidism later on in life. And then also none of these individuals, both controls and subjects, could have precocious puberty. As far as the treatment goes, we've mentioned surgery a little bit, but we're going to go into a bit more detail about what was done here. So none of these boys received any sort of hormonal therapy. Alan walked us through a few things that have been tried throughout the years, but none of these individuals received any medical treatment. And children with cryptorchidism, those boys were followed up until the age of 18 months. If at 18 months, the cryptorchidism persisted, had not spontaneously corrected, then those individuals were referred to a surgeon. And then an orchiopexy was performed. It was done almost always prepubertally. So there's one exception, which we'll come back to, but the median age of that was 2, just like Alan mentioned, important to do this early on. There was one individual who initially had spontaneous descent, but then had a recurrence. And then so because of that late recurrence, there was a surgery that was after puberty. But that was the only exception to that. As far as the protocol goes for following these boys, there were a physical exam, testicular ultrasound, that occurred regularly. That started at age 8.5 and occurred every 6 months until there was no further testicular growth on 3 consecutive visits. There was frequent lab testing. Marcella mentioned this in the introduction already, but to walk you through that, so at all of these visits, there was blood drawn. So at the initial visit, there were blood samples, and then every 6 months, there was a variety of things that were done. So as far as examination goes, testicular length was measured. That's what drove the lab measurements, and that was continued on. So starting once the testicular growth was over 20 millimeters until full pubertal maturation. And every 6 months, there was a blood draw for FSH, LH, total testosterone, inhibin B, SHBG, estradiol, IGF-1, and IGF-BP3. And then at the last blood draw, there was also the lab that Marcella mentioned, the serum insulin-like factor 3. All of these samples were analyzed at the same lab. The technicians there were blinded, and the samples were obtained at different times of day. Most of them were in the morning, somewhere between 7:30 and 11 a.m., but many of them were later on in the day. Okay, so we've walked through a bunch of the protocols here. I think a couple of things that are worth us understanding a little bit more, and I'm going to get Alan to help us out here. So Alan, a couple of questions for you. So one, the timing of the collection, do we need to worry about that it was variable? Yes, mostly in the morning, but a lot of them later on in the day. And then also help us understand a little bit more about why some of these, the gonadotropins, testosterone, that makes sense, but IGF-1, this insulin-like factor 3, help us understand why those might have been interest in this study.
Time of day is probably not so important here. Time of day is really important for testosterone. If you're a big person, it's a maybe 30% difference between 8 o'clock in the morning and 4 o'clock in the afternoon. For us in pediatrics, it's quite different. The levels are low until puberty and we don't worry about it so much. But early mid-puberty, mid-puberty, the levels can be 400 in the morning and 40 in the afternoon. Same kid, but it's that just that the GnRH fires only when you start to get up in the morning. LH, T is high, and then it peters off during the day. And then as you go to more mature levels of puberty, then you have LH and T in longer parts of the day. So I don't think that is quite so important. Why would you measure some of these things? I think you carefully told us about the HPG axis. Turns out IGF-BP3 is the major binding protein for insulin-like growth factor 1. I'm not so sure why they got that. But for sure, IGF-1 and growth hormone do have an effect on the growth of the genitalia. And if you're a baby, you don't need to be gonadotropin deficient as well as growth hormone deficient to have small genitalia. So there is an effect of growth hormone. INSL3 is a fetal hormone, and it is somehow related to the descent of the testis. I'm not so sure it's that helpful when one is getting older, but I really don't know very much about it more than that. It is also in the ovary, and people don't really know why it's there.
Thank you. That's helpful. So now we're going to move on to the statistics and just touch on a couple of high-level points here. So I mentioned this before, but want to go through it again because it's going to be helpful here before Marcella walks us through. But thinking about these groups, so there are 5 different study groups. So one is you have controls. Your second group are those individuals, those boys with unilateral cryptorchidism who had orchiopexy, who had surgical correction. Then you have a third group, unilateral cryptorchidism, who had spontaneous descent. A fourth group are those individuals with bilateral cryptorchidism who required surgical correction with an orchiopexy. And then finally, the fifth group, those individuals with bilateral cryptorchidism who had spontaneous descent. So subdivided into those 5 groups. As those are looked at, the authors applied covariates of models for the pubertal age, or at least the time since the onset of puberty. Also that timing of when those blood samples were drawn. Alan said maybe not a huge deal, but they wanted to try to account for that as much as possible. Which study group you're in, and then interactions between these variables to allow for analysis of whether the differences between groups varied during the study and to control for potential differences in the effect of the timing of the blood sampling. One thing that I do think would be helpful, and this is something I'll start here in a second with getting Alan's thoughts on, are some of the things that we don't know as far as the information that's collected here. The authors point out that in some of their initial studies, in particular, a case control study that they did before, that was where some of these individuals came from, they matched the subjects to make sure that the groups were as similar as possible. But when all these invitations went out to individuals who participated in these previous studies, only a minority of the individuals agreed to continue on in this current study. So 28% of those with cryptorchidism and 21% of controls. And so we don't know that these groups are very similar because they're only a minority from the original groups participated. And in this report, very little information is provided comparing these two groups. And I would say this includes even relatively basic stuff like BMI. We don't know if that differed from one group versus another. So Alan, help us understand here, is there other stuff that maybe we would have liked to have known that could have had an impact? I think BMI, I mentioned that, at least again, in adults, total testosterone, that could be very different depending upon what the BMI is. And so there is some stuff we might want to know here, but how would you think about that?
Probably a height Z-score, even as crude as Tanner staging, although the hormones might cover that, and the interim medical history. You know, did they have a head injury? I'm making that up. But the interval history is 10 years. That's a pretty good size chunk of time of these kids, 13, 14, 17 years old. And so that would be helpful. I do agree strongly that no matter what, when you get a minority or a large minority of the patients only, that you really do have to take one step back and say, maybe there are some other things going on. There are two things that I would like to mention. One, these kinds of studies can only be done in Scandinavia or Finland because they have such a great medical record. They track you. The second has to do with testicular ultrasound. The old Prader method, the way that all of us have learned how to do this, is really pretty good once the testis is above 6 or 8 mL, whether you measure its semi-major axis and convert it, or you just use the Prader beads. But if you use ultrasound, especially below 5 mL, which is what us pediatricians deal with, ultrasound is very different than the palpation method. And it turns out, I just glancingly looked at some material from adults, that it turns out that even in the adult, although measurements done by palpation and measurements done by ultrasound march upward, they really are quite different, and you cannot compare the two. So I think it is safer to have the ultrasound method because you've got that archived. You can always go back and say that's how you did it. But it shouldn't make very much difference except in the kids that have 5 mL and below testis.
Excellent. So very, very helpful here. So we're going to move on. We got a few caveats to keep in mind. So we've got different groups. We're not totally sure about the difference here other than the information related to the cryptorchidism. So we're going to keep that in mind. But I'm going to turn things over to Marcella now, and she's going to walk us through the results as presented by the authors, and we'll think about those in more detail. Marcella?
So the results section is divided in 4 subsections, and so I'll do each of one separately. So the results are shown in figures 1 through 4, and the first section shows us results for FSH and inhibin B levels and the differences among the study groups. So both FSH and inhibin B levels differed significantly between each of the groups. And the significant differences were the following. So for those boys with a history of bilateral cryptorchidism who needed orchiopexy, FSH levels were higher and inhibin B levels were lower when compared to controls. And this was seen since the onset of puberty. Those who had a history of bilateral cryptorchidism, but with spontaneous descent, did show an increase in FSH levels and a decline in inhibin B levels. But this was only seen after 1.5 years since the onset of puberty. Also, when the actual levels were compared to the controls, the levels were similar. But it is important to remember that this group had a very small number of boys in it, and so results were variable, and we have to be careful when we analyze these results given the small n. And then lastly, those with unilateral cryptorchidism, both with and without a history of orchiopexy, had higher FSH levels than controls, but this was seen only after 2 years since the onset of puberty, and inhibin B levels were not significantly different for this group. Now, the second section shows results for SHBG, LH, testosterone, and insulin-like factor 3. So for SHBG, the patterns were different between the five groups, but the significant difference was that the levels were lower in the group that had bilateral cryptorchidism and spontaneous descent when compared with controls, but this was only seen at the 0.5-year mark after pubertal onset. LH and testosterone levels patterns did not differ significantly between the groups, and this was similar for insulin-like factor 3, in which there were no differences between the groups either. The third section shows the results for growth factors. And so both IGF-1 and IGF-BP3 levels were different between the groups, but the significant differences were the following. So for IGF-1, these levels were higher in boys with a history of bilateral cryptorchidism who needed surgery, but the difference was only significant 1 year after the onset of puberty. IGF-1 levels were also higher in those with unilateral cryptorchidism and spontaneous descent, and this was noticed only after 2 years since the onset of puberty. And regarding IGF-BP3 levels, these were lower than controls in boys that had bilateral cryptorchidism and a history of spontaneous descent, but this was only seen at the 1.5-year mark after the onset of puberty. And then lastly, the fourth section shows us results for testicular volume. So here they compared boys with spontaneous descent versus those who had surgery versus controls. And they showed that testicular volumes were different between all the groups. So when they combined the testicular volume in those who had a history of orchiopexy, and so here they combined both with unilateral and bilateral cryptorchidism who underwent surgery, the testicular size was significantly smaller in this group than compared to controls, and this was evident from 1 year after the onset of puberty. And then those who had spontaneous descent, again, including both those with unilateral and bilateral cryptorchidism, there was no significant difference in testicular volume when compared with control. So the only significant difference in testicular size was seen in those who had a history of orchiopexy.
Thank you, Marcel. So a lot of information just walked us through here. So we're gonna go through all that carefully here. And the way we're going to do that is normal. We're going to start with how the authors describe that. So the author's conclusion, so they have three main conclusions that they draw. So first of all, they say that the severity of cryptorchidism plays a role in serum reproductive hormone levels during puberty, specifically FSH and inhibin B, but doesn't seem to affect the LH, testosterone, SHBG, and growth factors. The second point that they make is that the orchiopexy didn't seem to normalize the FSH and inhibin B or testicular volume. And then finally is that the group differences in FSH and inhibin B became more pronounced as puberty progressed. Okay, so three big findings here. We're going to think about that. First, though, the authors make a few comparisons. And so one of the things that they note is that higher FSH and lower inhibin B in prepubertal boys with bilateral cryptorchidism after an orchiopexy, but not those with spontaneous descent or unilateral disease, suggests that they have Sertoli cell dysfunction. And they point out that their results are in line with those of studies that looked at adult men, in particular, noting that other studies of men with bilateral cryptorchidism are associated with higher FSH, lower inhibin B, smaller testicular size. And also in those studies, no difference in Leydig cell function between patients who had cryptorchidism and those with controls. They point out that the higher IGF-1 levels in those with bilateral cryptorchidism who had to undergo orchiopexy could suggest a compensatory drive for testicular growth. And with all of that, the authors say, well, there's two likely, or at least two possible explanations for the changes that we see in those with bilateral disease who required a surgery. So one explanation for that is they say, well, this could represent inherent testicular dysgenesis, and surgery does not fully correct that underlying issue, and that's why we see these persistent hormonal changes. A different explanation is that, well, Well, actually, it's not that at all. It's that there is damage to the testicles from longer duration in the undescended position. And obviously, it could be a combination of these two things as well. So now one thing, and this has come up just a little bit already, this got mentioned briefly by Alan in the introduction. But Marcella, as we were reviewing this article and doing our analysis, she pointed out to me that actually the age of surgical intervention in this study is different than what is typical, at least with current practice in the United States. So Marcella, expand on that just a little bit. Help us understand what you meant by that point.
Sure. So yeah, so what they did in this study, as you mentioned earlier, is that by 18 months, if there was no spontaneous descent, then these boys were referred to the surgeon. The median age was 2 years with, you know, a range from 0.26 years to a little bit over 4 years. And the ones who had the surgery done before 18 months, which were three boys, they had it done earlier because they needed another surgery, for example, for inguinal hernia repair. But most boys had the surgery done after 18 months. So in the United States and actually other countries, including, you know, South America and Europe, from talking with other colleagues, that typical practice is that if there's no testicular descent, at least by 12 months, patients will be referred to the surgeon. And so usually orchiopexy will be performed between the first and second year of life, but closer to the first year of life. There is a trend now to do the surgeries earlier. And, you know, in the urology community, they used to follow guidelines where they felt more comfortable doing the surgery as long as it was before the age of two. But there seems to be a trend where it's in favor of doing surgeries earlier, sometime between 6 and 12 months of age. So the median age and where most patients had surgery done in this study did seem sort of at an older age than what is typically done.
Yeah, and that's going to be really helpful as we think about these two possible explanations, because that directly impacts that second one. The idea is that, well, maybe the longer that the testicles are in this undescended position, the more damage that there is acquiring. So if, say, the typical practice here, at least in the United States, is to not wait that long, well, maybe that's not going to be entirely applicable. But let's go back and just think about those potential explanations. Alan, why don't you help us out with that? So as you know this field, and as you've seen other studies, any thoughts or conclusions that you would draw on which of these might be more likely, or is it potentially a combination of the two, or how would you think about these two possible explanations for what we're seeing here?
For sure, there are problems in fetal development. That probably involves most of the testes. Then there may be problems in the descent. Now, here, there is something that hasn't been chatted about, and that is two questions. How long was the testis there and where was it? They didn't separate intra-abdominal, which would have been another group. And again, they wouldn't have had enough people. And so a testis that is at 37 degrees in the abdomen is likely different than a testis that may be at 34 or 5 degrees halfway down in the inguinal canal. So that would be one of the things that would concern me that we don't know about, meaning that all of the things that we measure, we may be not figuring the correct things, that those are only a consequence of what happened rather than what drove them. So from my point of view, it's really difficult to separate unless you've got hundreds of kids, which you're never going to get. The other issue is the hormones that were measured, none of them gave a clue as to who would need surgery or who wouldn't need surgery. And I think that's important because there is such a thing called mini puberty in kids who go through puberty at age 8, 10 weeks. They have a big time testosterone, then it goes away. And so that is a window in which one can determine testicular function without doing invasive things. And so the INSL is a Leydig cell product. And so you can measure that compartment by measuring INSL3. I'm sorry, not INSL. And then the Sertoli cell, FSH and inhibin involve that. And so you can get a window of the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal function during this very truncated period of mini puberty.
So we're going to keep thinking about those as we move along here. So first of all, a few more points that the authors make. So some notes that they make on strengths of their studies. They point out this is a longitudinal study design. They also point out that there's a relatively short interval between follow-up visits throughout puberty. And then finally, they point out that testicular position was well documented at birth so that no boys with acquired cryptorchidism were included. So it was a more homogeneous group. A few limitations that they note. So one is that it is a relatively small number of subjects, particularly in the bilaterally cryptorchid group. And that Alan's pointed out, there are not a lot of individuals with this, so it's going to be hard to have anything besides small studies. Another limitation is that there is that variability in time of the blood sampling. They point out that this was done primarily to make it easier for families, but was a trade-off in making that decision. It wasn't as consistent as they might have liked. And then finally, there was not a comparison done between early and late orchiopexy. And then there's difficulty controlling for this due to other factors implicated in the timing of the surgery. Marcella gave us an example of that already. And so they were not able to make any comparisons there. Finally, with the author's summary, so their main point that they make here is that the main long-term consequence for testicular function in boys with congenital cryptorchidism, particularly after bilateral orchiopexy, includes altered development of Sertolian germ cells, but that Leydig cell function is generally well-preserved, at least during puberty. So that's their conclusion. Now we're going to go back and think about this in general. So first of all, I just wanted to get a sense of quality of this report overall here and some thoughts about its generalizability, given some comments that we've made already. So Marcella, why don't you help us out with this? Just give us a sense overall, what are your thoughts on this paper and how easy is this going to be for us to apply to patients that we are seeing?
So in general, we just discussed one issue which might make this a little bit less applicable, which is the age at which the orchiopexy was done. Of course, the late orchiopexy could have affected the result. And so it will be great if we could, you know, evaluate the same outcomes in a cohort in which the orchiopexy is done at an earlier time to give us better answers of really what really had the effect on the results that we saw and if the timing really was an issue implicated or not. Now, that being said, the results regarding the lack of effect on Leydig cell function are consistent with prior studies. And also even with the later age at orchiopexy, we saw no effect, which is definitely something that's important because there is not a lot of knowledge or good data in this area. So definitely this does add to that area. And when we are counseling patients and family, of course, we are monitoring them in terms of how their testicles grow, how they progress through puberty, and of course, what the fertility prognosis might be. So for us as pediatric endocrinologists, of course, it is important to understand that we do need to talk to families about it, that maybe we don't have to worry as much about, you know, testicular production of testosterone or testosterone replacement, for example, based on the data that's out there. But also even for adult endocrinologists, of course, it's important to realize that testicular size can be different just because a patient, you know, 30 years ago had a history of cryptorchidism, for example. And then, of course, the implications in terms of germ cell function, but also the fact that they might not have issues with production of hormones from the testicle. So I do think that it is important to take this data into consideration. And I think it is helpful for our counseling and monitoring of these patients.
Good. Alan, let's get some input from you. So first question of two, as we think about always, we always want more data and more studies. So if we were to do another study on this, Marcella mentioned already, she'd be interested in having a comparison with orchiopexy happening at an earlier age. Any other data, though, that you would be interested in if a future study were to be done in these individuals?
Not really. And I say not really because to me, the most important issues haven't really been spoken to. And that has to do with there's no implication here for fertility and there's no implication here for germ cell tumor. Those are the two things that if we go back to the very beginning when Marcella or I would talk to the parents, those are the things that they're most interested in. And the fertility issue is a little bit of a difficult one because most people would say, well, gee, the kid is growing normally. He is maturing normally. but they don't really understand that that part of the testis is quite separate from the other part of the testis that gives them grandchildren.
So then a final question for you. Marcel has given us some suggestions of implications, both on the pediatric and adult side, which I think is helpful. And you've highlighted that as well, is that that even though sperm production and testosterone production often go together, they don't necessarily, there's not a one-to-one correlation there when problems show up. But other implications, I always think about a pediatric endocrinologist like Marcella, adult endocrinologist like me. What implications would you see that we should think about applying to the patients that we see who perhaps have had cryptorchidism in the past?
Well, to me would be monitoring. And I'm not clever enough to know how often you need to do that, although germ cell tumors are tumors of young men. And so monitoring either by ultrasound or by palpation would be more important in this group of patients. And the second one would be probably, I can't tell you when, maybe every 5 years, have a sperm count. But those would be the two kinds of things that would concern me the most, that they don't show up from the outside. It's not like your finger falling off and you would know that. But the point is monitoring, and remember the thing that happens between Marcella and me and you is called transition. And at transition, there is a lot of information lost. And so this is a kind of thing that would be important, whether you want to be fancy and call it a transition document or something like that. But the big people's doctor really needs to know about these things so she or he can take care of the emerging adult, young adult, et cetera. So those would be my thoughts offhand.
And with that, I would like to thank Marcella Vargas and Alan Rogel for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope you all learned as much as I did and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society, with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon.